Well, we have topics. We also have callers. And Richard.
Hello, Stefan.
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well.
And that's good.
I'm eager to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, sure. I actually have a question, Stefan. I wonder if you could give your opinion on any connection, if any, between wisdom and virtue.
Interesting. So I think there are instances of wisdom that are not specific to virtue, but I'm not sure there are any instances of virtue that are not specific to wisdom. In other words, I think wisdom is a larger category and virtue is a smaller category. And what I mean by that is you could say it's wise to go into a profession where you're going to have long-term enjoyment, where your skill set is good, you're going to have the meaning in what you're doing to push through obstacles. It's wise to do that.
Okay.
But it's not a question of good or evil.
Fair enough.
And it is wise to be, you know, honest and direct with your friends, but it's not a question of good or evil. But I don't think there's any good or evil that doesn't involve wisdom. I think wisdom is a balancing act between long-term and short-term benefits. So if you are a hedonist, then you will burn up the pleasure of the future for the sake of the pleasure in the moment. And that's unwise. If you are if you are too much of a miser, then you keep deferring gratification until there's really no happiness at all. You know, the people who sort of scrimp and save their whole lives and then they become such misers, they never end up spending any money on anything and they kind of die rich and miserable. So it is a balance. And the reason why we need wisdom is these things change in life.
Sure.
If I remember rightly, you're not dissimilar from my age. And, you know, each age has its charms, its advantages and disadvantages, except maybe the very last year or whatever of your life.
Sure.
But, you know, when I was a young man, it was important to go out and carve my way and shoulder my way through every obstacle and push on no matter what. And as you get older, you're supposed to get a little bit more mellow, a little bit more comfortable in what it is that you've done. So I think wisdom is knowing when to push hard, knowing when to relax a little bit. You don't want a life of endless striving, but at the same time, you don't want a life where you don't achieve anything. So I think finding these balances over changing times. I was very ambitious out there in the world until I became a father almost 18. Well, technically, it was more than 18 years ago because you become a father when you get a girl pregnant. So
sure.
I was very ambitious in the world, and then I became, I wouldn't say ambitious, because not really, but mm-hmm. My big goal was to be a good father and a good husband, of course. So I think that wisdom is trying to find a balance, and again, not knowing the things that are going to occur in life, trying to find a balance between short and long-term pleasures so that you get a reasonable amount of maximum pleasure and virtue in life, if that makes sense. So that's a very sort of rough outline of wisdom, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I would tend to agree with that. Would you think time preference plays into this as well? Mm.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you're young, it's more important to defer gratification because the costs and benefits are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're young, you know, the great temptation when you're young is to chase girls, to go travel, to stay up late, to, you know, maybe go to university and have some fun. And because you've got youthful energy and all of that, so and of course, you're in the prime of your physical and mental alertness and fitness and health. And so the goal when you're young for a lot of people, and I've certainly fallen prey to this on countless occasions, is to just go out and have fun.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, you know, enjoy yourself. And so, and the problem, of course, is that if you do that too much, then you end up without a firm foundation of skills and abilities and value for the middle and later part of your life. If you spend your life from like 18 to 30, just, you know, working dead-end jobs and traveling and drinking and smoking and toking and sleeping around and stuff like that. I mean, hey, that's fun, I guess. I mean, don't get me wrong. But then you're 30 and you got nothing. You got nothing. And I remember, I think I mentioned this story many years ago. A friend of mine, we'll just call him Bob, was a very charismatic and good-looking guy. And he worked as a bartender.
Okay.
And then he went to school for marketing or something like that. And then he went on an overseas, like, backpack across Europe, sleep in hostels and so on. And then he came back and he saw his boss who lived in the neighborhood, and his boss was like, hey, man, you got to come back to the bar. Everybody misses you. And he was like, yeah, the bar was like really good money. You know, I got to meet a lot of girls and have a lot of fun and, you know, and all of that. And that's where my skill set is. And he's like, but he had to sort of shake himself and say, no, 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 I've got to go and get a job in an office. And I got to go and start the corporate grind. And I've got to start, because there's no future in particular in the bartending world. And of course, every job that you have where you live the opposite is a job for weirdos. You know, like, bartenders are like, every job you have where you're working while everyone is playing and you're sleeping while everyone else is working is just a job that leads straight to the sort of Stygian weirdo, nose piercing, tattoo laced underworld. And it's like actors and, you know, karaoke hosts and bartenders and things like that. And even waiters, right? Because waiters work when everyone else is eating and playing and off work and so on. I mean, that's kind of the nature of the business, you know, hotel clerk and so on. And so, yeah, he just had to kind of grit his teeth, and he ended up having a good career in the world of marketing and business and so on. And, but yeah, it was really tempting. He knew the bartending world. He knew it was going to work out well. He knew he could make some good money, but also there really wasn't going to be anywhere he could go further or forward much more doing that. So yeah, when you're young, you have to defer gratification when your youthful energy these days, you know, what do you want to do when you're young? Well, we're sort of trained to go hunting. We're trained to go to war. With, you know, that's sort of what our instincts are. That's what nature has trained us for.
Yep.
And you know, sometimes you got to suit up and just grind in a cubicle or you know, maybe start a business and whatever it is, and you've got to try and find some way to really increase the value that you can add to the world from an economic standpoint. Otherwise, your middle age and later tends to be like, I know a lot of people when I was younger, when I was first in university, and you know, they went to computer stuff, they did computer stuff, and what happened was they stayed in the computer world and they stayed as programmers. And with programmers, the problem is, I remember I had a friend of mine who was good at the language called Mantis, like the insect. And there was a whole bunch of code at some company that was written in Mantis, and he had to maintain it and update it and Y2K it and all that kind of stuff. But with programmers, you get good at a particular language and then you get stuck on that language.
Right.
Because you're the guy who's good at that language, and there's, you know, millions of lines of code. I mean, my first programming job was with COBOL 74. IBM stock recently took a hit because AI is figuring out COBOL, and that's common object business oriented language. I think COBOL or something like that always makes me think of the little creatures in Dungeons and Dragons, but it's COBOL. But those guys all had great careers doing maintenance programming and made good money. It was boring as hell. It was not creative.
Right, right.
Because it's like, I remember being given a code. Oh my God, I was given this code base, and it was a program to determine optimal hair cutting, which is a sort of technical term in the investment world. And it was like, I don't know, 50,000 lines of code, and there was a bug in it somewhere that was producing some, and I had to step through it line by line on a tandem operating system, and you had to query each variable content as it was stepping through. And it was just like, I remember printing it out and drawing all these big logic maps. And it's like, it is about as exciting as archaeology, not in the Spielberg movies, but in real life, where most of the time you're just not doing anything of particular interest.
Yeah, yeah.
And so these guys, they all got into coding. And then they kind of got stuck on this maintenance coding. And I remember them saying to me, like, hey, it's good money, but I want to shoot myself, you know? That's a problem in life, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's good money because they had to pay them good money to keep them on this code. Because, you know, this code executed tens of millions of dollars of trades every day. I really jumped in on the deep end when it came to programming. And, you know, so they went for the money. They didn't defer the gratification. Deferring gratification would have been, okay, well, I'm going to take a pay cut and I'm going to go do something entrepreneurial. I'm going to do something in this new, the web languages that were just coming out and so on. And I remember I worked in the same room with like five guys, and they were great guys. They were great guys. I really enjoyed working with them. We had a lot of fun, and they introduced me into a lot of sort of good business practices and work practices and so on. I remember the one guy I was friends with was like, man, you take your job too seriously, man. It's not that serious. And it's like, hey, it's not that serious for you. You come from money. It's pretty serious for me. I don't. You know?
Yeah.
Get you another job, no problem. And I remember when I was quitting, they said, oh, you're quitting, man. You've only been here a year. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I want to start a business, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this flicker across their face, right? Across their face, like, oh, man. And then they'd look at their bills. They'd look at their kids. They'd look at their private school tuition fees. They'd look at whatever, right? And it'd be like, oh, man, I wish I could come with you, but I'm chained to this desk with golden metal or something like that.
Golden handcuffs, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that they did not defer the gratification of making less money and getting into something entrepreneurial. But it was like, A, I need the money, and B, you know, my wife would kill me if I took on something entrepreneurial because that would be 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And so a different phase of life or whatever. But, you know, I just stay in touch with them for a while after that. We would have lunch periodically for the next, I don't know, sort of 3 to 5 years until it sort of inevitably tailed off. But yeah, they were still doing the same jobs and still making money. And I just remember one of them over lunch saying, man, I cannot remember any individual workday from like the last 10 years. I was just like, oh, no. Oh, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard. I can't remember any individual. I mean, I remember so, I won't get into it because I know you've got questions, but I remember just about every day doing this show for the last 21 years because they've all been so different and so interesting. And of course, I have records on them, but I remember the guy doing the Mantis code was like, yeah. I said, oh, I had lunch with him. It's like, hey, what's due this morning? He's like, oh, man, it was rough. So I'm supposed to find a bug in this 100,000 line Mantis program. And I kept paging through it until I hit the bottom. And then I realized I haven't absorbed anything. So I'd go back up to the top and I'd page down. And then I'd get to the bottom and say, well, geez, what have I really learned or thought of or whatever? And so he basically is like, I just hit the page down and stared like a guppy at the screen. It's like that was his day.
So. Yeah, that's brutal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's a bit of a side quest.
No, it's good. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, in the Bitcoin community, how, you know, you and I are old farts now. You're not officially an old fart yet. Given September coming, you might be.
I'm not an old fart, but I'm getting gassy.
Anyway, but the Bitcoin community is quite interesting, isn't it, in the sense that there's an enormous amount of creativity and mostly young people, right? Young guys, mostly. And it's, you know, I find it really quite exciting in the sense that, and a lot of these young guys are like very, you know, low time preference guys. They're all kind of getting into that mindset. And that gives me great hope. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. That really is a moral mission to change the world.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I would certainly say this to younger people, like, take rational risks, for heaven's sakes.
Yep.
Take, I mean, don't just, you know, jump off a cliff and hope something will catch you, but you know, take rational risks. You really, really should look back upon your life with one big risk you've taken. One big risk. That you've taken. I mean, hopefully more than one as a whole.
Yeah.
But if you play it safe, you're not living. If you play it too safe. Play it too dangerous, you're almost dying. Play it too safe, you're barely living.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And you got to look back and you say, okay, well, at least I took that risk.
Yeah, yeah.
And so looking back on your life, just so I don't ramble everyone into oblivion, give me some of the things you look back on with some pride at risks that you took.
Risks. That's interesting, right? Yeah, I've always felt like I've been not risk averse at all. Not that much. And I feel like, you know, if you don't take a chance on life, then what are your hopes and dreams, really? Like, you know, so, you know, like, take, for example, that there was this project where at the time my partner and I, there was this house for sale and it was a wreck and there had been a fire in it. There had been a bunch of methods living it and creatures as well. And I said, you know, come on,
Sorry, did you say meth heads and creatures?
Yeah, creatures, not creatures. Yeah. I don't know what the difference is. Anyway, yeah, and that was amazing because she said, oh, yeah, for sure, let's do it kind of thing, right? Whereas in my previous time, going back in time a ways, when I was married and, you know, at the time it was just, we'd only been married a couple of years and we moved to a place in Ontario that was kind of a depressed place. And you could buy property there like for next to nothing almost. And I said, oh, come on, let's buy this. And then she was like, oh, my God, but look at it. It's kind of too ugly and, you know, isn't... And I said, no, that's perfect. Come on, we can fix it up. We can do something with this. And it was like, oh, no, I've got to find a place that's kind of perfect to begin with. So when this other... Later on in my life, when I met this other woman and we took on this place and... It was just so fantastic because I thought, oh my God, thank goodness. I've got this person who's not so risk averse that, you know, everything's got to be perfect. And we made this house into like an incredible place. It was so exciting. It was like, and I've always been really good with tools in my hands and creativity and all that. And back at that time, actually, you could download SketchUp. You remember that? And it was free for download. Now it's all been taken over by Google and stuff. But, yeah, so I downloaded SketchUp, learned how to use it, measured the whole place and redesigned the whole place using SketchUp. And then we just gutted this place, completely gutted it, reconfigured the whole place. And then it was just like, oh my God, it was just amazing when we finished it. It was just like so beautiful. And I just completely dove down the well of creativity. We both did. And it was just exciting to take that risk. And then at the end of it, see how it paid off. You know, it was wonderful. Yeah. And it was.
Sorry, I didn't mean. You sounded like you were ending there, waiting for me to come in, and that's totally fine. So that's good. That's good. Yeah. So maybe we can sort of make that a theme if people want to talk about rational, reasonable risks. I think it's a very interesting topic.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that young men are not really taught much about risk these days in particular, which is why I think young men are, you know, porn and video game addicts, because those are ways of having pretend achievements, but without the actual risk. And I think that comes a lot from just having, I mean, obviously there's the kind of low trust society stuff, but then there's also just the women kind of anxious a lot of times.
Yeah.
I don't have any particular problem with that. I think that's actually, that's good. That's kind of why we all make it through to adulthood, is because women are kind of anxious. I was reading this article today, which was about women and serotonin. Now, I know serotonin is supposed to be associated with mood and all of that.
Yep.
And it was talking about how hugely low serotonin is relative to men's, that men have just more mood buoyancy and so on. And this is one of the reasons why women will often fall into, you know, anxiety and depression and these sort of negative states of mind, because women are have evolved to worry about often things, some things obviously beyond their control. You know, for most of human history, or at least our evolution, women had to bury children and they could do really nothing to save them. They turned to these ridiculous witch doctors, aka modern psychiatrists, and wouldn't really be able to save their babies or anything like that. And this is why I think women as a whole need men to help regulate their emotions.
Absolutely. Because, 100%.
Sometimes male practicality can be a good antidote to female anxiety. And of course, women have things to offer men as well, which is women being on a shorter reproductive clock will often try and get men to settle down and take life more seriously when they're younger. So women are essential for men taking life more seriously, and men are essential for helping women take life less seriously. And I think that sort of combination is really productive and good.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
so I think that young men, if you're raised with this sort of bubble-wrapped, anxious mother, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that kind of mindset, then you just don't learn how to handle or manage risk. And if you don't learn how to handle or manage risk, I think most people end up living lives that are too risk-averse because there's too much anxiety. Right? I remember, of course, when my daughter was learning her acrobatics and so on, it would make my wife's heart jump into her throat to watch my daughter do these crazy jumps off walls and, you know, ride her bike with no hands and so on. And I'm like, it's
awesome,
it's
right?
Alarming. It's alarming. You know, don't get me wrong. I agree with you. It's alarming.
No, I mean, it's awesome. Right? That's what I mean.
Well, yeah. And look, I mean, it was a little easier when you had expendable kids, right?
Yeah, right.
It's a little easier, but now we don't really have expendable kids
anymore. Yeah, sure.
And so it's pretty tough. But it is really essential for kids to go through that whole process. But it's very tough on the moms, but it's essential for the kids.
Yeah.
And I just don't think kids are going through that. What was your sort of mom and dad and risk stuff when you were growing up?
Well, when I was really young, I had a pretty awesome childhood up until when my parents broke up. And, you know, my whole childhood was really basically being left to my own devices and just going out and exploring the world. And, getting all into...
Sorry to interrupt right when you're starting. Just for the younger people, because the word devices now means iPads, being left to your own devices means having no money, no toys, no car, no bus fare, no money at all.
Yep.
Being left to your own devices means you have to invent your own fun. And my God, it was glorious.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, my mistake there, right? Devices means a whole different thing these days. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my device, left to my own creativity. Let's put it that way, right? And and it was awesome. I mean, my goodness me, I've got so many incredibly rich memories of those early childhood days. And we just go out and just like, you know, like not wreak havoc at all, but have just like so much fun and getting into, you know, like possibly dangerous situations. We spoke about this before, you know, like long before parkour became a thing. You know, I was leaping over buildings and doing all kinds of nonsense like that with my friend. Yeah, and we would just find really kind of, you know, interesting things to do, like climbing on the pier at the coastal town where I lived and was brought up in England. Yeah, and then we figure out a way of like climbing onto the pier, and there's this big overhang, and we thought, okay, that's a challenge. Let's do that, and we figure that out. And there's all these old guys fishing off the side of the pier, and all of a sudden these kids would be clambering over the railing from God knows where, and they were looking at us like, where did you come from? We was like, oh yeah, we beat that challenge, right? And that was just like the theme of my childhood, and I feel so sad for kids if they don't experience that. Or some version of that, put it that way.
Well, they don't anymore. Kids stay home. And, you know, part of that is, you know, over diversity and a sort of lack of comfort with all of the various cultures and religions and languages and who knows what from who knows where that's floating around neighborhoods. A lot of this is too much female power in relationships and marriages. and a lack of assertiveness for the men to say, in particular, let boys be boys.
Yeah, let boys be boys.
Because every time, like every time a boy takes his hands off his bike handle, right?
Yep.
The mother, what does the mother see in her mind's eye? She sees the sirens. She sees bone shards sticking out of skin. She sees maybe a visit from the government. She sees like every negative conceivable, horrifying. She sees there's a in a movie, was the 70s, I think, called Kramer versus Kramer.
Right. Okay. Right.
There's a scene where the boy, it's about a couple that splits up. And I found it actually quite an interesting movie. But it's about a couple that splits up. And what happens is the father is taking care of the boy. And the boy falls from a play center, falls from the top of some climbing boards or something
Right? Yeah.
And the dad is running down the street and he's injured and so on. And this comes up in the divorce. This comes up in the custody battle.
Oh, man.
The dad.
Yeah.
The child was injured under the dad's watch.
Right. Right.
And to me, if you're watching a kid for years and years and that kid doesn't get injured at all,
right,
I can't even think that you're a good parent. I can't, because you are choking that child's capacity to evaluate risk. I remember that really vividly in the theater, like, oh my God, he fell, and all the women in the movie theater were like, oh my God. And it was like, yeah, so he did something foolish and he fell.
Right.
And he did not break an arm. He did not, like, he just, I don't know, I can't remember what happened. He got some strawberry elbow or something like that.
Right.
Or maybe he did break his arm. I don't know, but so he did. So he did. You know, yep. I there was a guy, a boy in the neighborhood who was really into dirt biking,
right,
like with motorized dirt biking.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he broke his arm twice.
Yeah. Yeah. The
option is what? Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I can remember my first motorcycle, right? I was 16 or something years old. And it was a dirt bike, right? And you could throw an L plate on the back of a dirt bike back then and just kind of go off on your own. And it was a 250cc thing. And I was just in love with that. And I remember going, I was coming up, I wasn't very aware of traffic, really, to be honest with you. And I was going up the street. It was a very quiet town with lots of older folks in it and stuff. I'm going up the street and all of a sudden this old lady pulls out in her Morris Minor. I run straight into the side of it, come off the bike. The bike goes under the vehicle. I slide across the tarmac, smash my head on the car, and then my dirt bike comes flying across and leaves tire tracks on my helmet. And I jump up.
Nice.
And I was pretty hurt, right? But I jump up and I was like, oh, man, you know, like, tell her to stop. Get a foot off the gas, because she still has a foot on the gas, right? And it was just fine. And I go home and it's like, oh, my bike's kind of written off. But there was no like, oh my God, there was no panic or any of that stuff, right? And I was like, okay. I had a few bruises and banged my knees up and whatever. And I kept that helmet as a kind of a point of pride, because it had these tire tracks over the top of it. And I was like, oh yeah, I've passed some kind of test here. You know what I mean? And I don't know. And it was just like, there was no kind of like big deal about it. It was, you know, it was serious and everything, but, and obviously took away some kind of, you know, lesson from that. But there was nobody kind of panicking about it. And there was, I broke my wrist at school and sprained the other one at the same time. Yeah, my dad came over and took me to hospital and got a cast and all that kind of stuff. But there was no kind of overreaction to me getting hurt. And I was kind of always injuring myself because I was always pushing the envelope. And and it was okay. You know what I mean? It wasn't like there was no feedback at all. But there was an appropriate amount of feedback, I guess. Right? You know what I mean? It felt just right.
Yeah. Well, and from an evolutionary standpoint, women look at individuals and men look at entire societies. And again, you know, both the collective and the individual have their importance and their relevance. But evolutionarily speaking, if you have tribes, you know, tribe A mm-hmm. and tribe B, and tribe B allows the male children to explore risk and get injured and learn the limits of their physical capabilities and thus develop courage.
Right.
Because you can't develop courage in the absence of risk.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how courageous can you be on a video game?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be that courageous. No, you can just reload a save or, you know, like it's not really anything serious.
Yeah, there's no feedback, right?
Well, no, there's feedback in that you could lose.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, there's no feedback in a sense of like reality feedback, right?
You know what I mean? There's no reality. You're not going to get injured, right? I mean, I remember when I used to play Facing Worlds, Capture the Flag in Unreal Tournament. And, you know, sometimes I would just charge down the main hallway with a hail of rockets raining down on me. And, you know, sometimes it would work, most times it wouldn't. But if it didn't work, no biggie. I just, you know, just maybe we lose the game or we do another one, but there's no injury, no.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't develop courage without risk.
Yeah, yeah.
And keeping the kids bubble wrapped, particularly the boys, has them unable to develop actual courage.
Yeah.
So if you've got tribe A and tribe B, tribe A bubble wraps the kids and the boys and doesn't teach them anything about danger and keeps them from doing anything risky and so on. And then they don't develop courage. And then when tribe B, who has let their boys do all of that, come over the hill to take their stuff, tribe B is going to win.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, without doubt.
And you can almost see that happening as a whole. Like I think about, you know, the changes that are going on in Ireland, which, you know, are very much against sort of traditional Irish identity. And when I was a kid, man, I was told from almost as soon as I remember anything to, you know, if you're waiting at the bus stop and there's a bank there, you've got to run because it could be a bomb from the IRA, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The IRA was going to protect England and was going to, sorry, protect Ireland and get the British out of Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of this. And they were, you know, pretty feral and ferocious and so on.
Yeah.
And now when, you know, arguably some big challenges, to put it mildly, are kind of happening in Ireland, like nobody's anywhere to be seen.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
And I think it has a lot to do with the bubble wrap childhoods, that people don't have a lot of courage anymore because they weren't allowed to experiment with genuine risk and danger when they were kids.
Yeah.
And that just simply means, evolutionarily speaking, you just get taken over by the tribe that allows their kids to experience risk.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are real consequences to this, aren't there? Yeah. And we're seeing it happen, right? You know, there's no free lunch, you know, as they used to say, you know, that.
No, and so the mothers are looking at each one of their individual, say, sons, and they're saying, well, you know, but Bobby and Jimmy and whoever, they can't take these risks because they could break their arm, they could, right? There was a comedian way back in the day who used to talk about how all the mothers in the neighborhood had a sudden lowered voice that they would talk about, you know, and they would say to their kids, you know, if you ride your bike without holding onto the handlebars, you're going to end up like little Bobby up the street who now can't even write his own name, you know, this little whisper of horror. And listen, that's fine. That's natural because risk is one of these things that you have to have an Aristotelian mean. And your society becomes a whole bunch of fraidy cats that can't push back against a hedgehog. Too much risk, and you know, kids get wiped out in bizarre experiments of physical danger and so on.
Yeah.
And I just think that way too much maternal fear and concern, because if there's too much maternal fear and concern and kids are kept away from risk, then the entire society falls apart in the long run, because there's no way to resist an invasion from other cultures that are more comfortable with risk and have developed more courage, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I remember the first time I came home with a black eye from school. This is when I was secondary school, high school, they call it over here, right? And my mum goes, oh my, what happened to you? I guess, I got into a little bit of a fight. She goes, oh, well, okay, well, let's put some ice on that. And that was it. This is the end of it. There was no like panic or over the top kind of like anything. And I just thought, yeah, okay, that's right. That makes sense. You know, I kind of took it out on this guy, and his bigger friend came back and punched me in the face. So good. That was good. That was a good lesson.
There's always a bigger kid around the corner, and you're not picking on the kid. You're picking on the kid and his three older brothers.
Yeah, right? Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, it's a good lesson. And it's funny, you know, because I have never been in a fight.
No, okay.
Now, you know, there's this sort of joke about the good-looking guy, the guy who's a model, and he gets into a fight, and he's like, not the face, not the face! Because, you know, that's how he makes his living.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, it was always like, I was willing to take about just about any risk, but not anything that might hurt my brain. Not the brain, not the brain. Yeah. That's how I'm going to make my living, or something like that. But yeah, I've always been able to talk my way out of things.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the one or two times that I was in some big physical altercation, I remember the time I've talked about when I was like 12 and the 17 or 18 year old bullies were keeping my friend and I confined in the woods and for a couple of hours and just bullying us and making fun of us and so on. I mean, I did stand up to them verbally. I got punched in the stomach. I just sort of pick on someone your own size, you cowards.
Yeah.
But I've always been able to talk my way out of things. I also have a really good spider sense of when things are going to go badly.
Yeah, that's a great thing to have. That is for sure.
Yeah, I'm always able to just like hit the eject button.
Oh yeah.
Because you can just see, you know, when that sort of black cloud is gathering around someone's head and slowly seeping into their ears. I'm pretty good at figuring that stuff out.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, not being around, because I don't in particular see the plus of it. But yeah, I mean, I exercise, I'm good at sports and all of that, but yeah, I've never been. I know some guys are like, hey, you don't even know who you are unless you've been in a fist fight. I'm like, yeah, maybe, but I'm actually pretty proud to have gotten to the age of, I mean, I, as you know, I have a big old mouth, man.
Well, you've taken risks. Yeah, hey man, you've put yourself in the fight, you've put yourself in the fight in such bigger ways than I've ever have. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I appreciate that. I prefer a physical fight to all of this, SPLC reputational destruction. It's all like mean girl shit.
No.
But yeah. I mean, I prefer dueling in a way, but I'm quite proud to have gotten to, you know, I don't think I'm going to get into too many fist fights going forward, but I'm quite proud to have taken that. And I think that the risks that I took as a child, and in particular as a teenager, were pretty good at teaching me how to balance risk. Because when I sort of look back at my career and sort of my time in the public square and the public space, and I compare myself to, you know, it's hard not to compare yourself to people. It really, I mean, it's impossible for me, at least. And I sort of looked, because for a while, like, I was down. Jordan Peterson was doing his big tours, and he signed with CAA, or Creative Artists Agency, to do his tour. And these are the guys who were happy to represent Harvey Weinstein, so I consider them to be, you know, a hive of scum and villainy, so to speak. And, you know, Jordan Peterson is up, and I'm down, and now I'm doing okay. Jordan Peterson is out with, it sounds like, from his daughter, Akathasia, from benzodiazepine addiction plus toxic mold or something like that. I don't quite follow some of this stuff as a whole. And, you know, Milo was up and I was down. I'm doing okay. Milo's around and still doing his thing and all of that. And it's just funny how the sort of wheel of fortune, you know, like if you don't like where you are in the hierarchy, just wait 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think having navigated a bunch of really topsy-turvy stuff over the course of my career, and, you know, coming through, I wouldn't say unscathed. Obviously, I have some battle scars I've landed a few blows, and, you know, a lot of blows have been landed on me too. But I think I had pretty good risk management, because I had to tell you, last thing I'll say, and I appreciate the chat, it's pretty wild. If anybody else wants to join, I know there were some other people who stepped up, and I'll just wind up here. It's pretty wild. I got to tell you, like, the stuff that was insanely controversial in 2011, 2012, 2013. And I was off Twitter for like, I don't know, 5 years or something like that, right? I mean, I'd browse from time to time, but I was off Twitter for like 5 years. And man, coming back and engaging in the conversations, it's kind of odd.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I used to be such an edgelord, and now I'm like completely middle of, in fact, I'm really conservative and boring on X in many ways at the moment, because I'm sort of have these old fast twitch PTSD battle scar muscles of like, ooh, I could post this, and then I sort of scroll through the feed and like things 10 times stronger than anything I could even think of or being sort of currently discussed in. And I mean obviously I had a little bit to do with that. There's a lot of people who've been moving that Overton window.
Yeah, for sure.
It's pretty wild to go back on X and to realize Ah, young Padawan, you have all learned very well, and there's nothing that I need to add to this. It's a pretty wild phenomenon, because I can't think of a time in history when things have changed from utterly ban-worthy to relatively banal
right.
in a half a decade. It's just crazy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Hey, listen, I'm gonna end here, right? Because you have other callers, and I hate to take up all the bandwidth, the time kind of thing. And I really, really appreciate your input, and I love your show, and I love listening to you and all your podcasts, all your episodes or whatever. And 100%. Thank you, Stefan.
You're very welcome, and I really do appreciate you calling in. I don't want to say it's a blast from the past, because it makes it sound like we're sort of two old men muttering on a porch while whittling outlines of our first girlfriends or something like that.
And thanks to James as well, James P. Yeah.
Why? What's James been doing?
I know he's part of your thing, and he helps out, and I think that I'm good. I just want to say thanks to him as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Sorry, I thought he'd done something particular for you. And that's actually, it's a good coincidence, because that's actually on James's job description and on his business card. Part of Steph's thing. That's what he's doing.
Well, there you go.
That's what he's owning.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks so much, Steph.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Always a pleasure, and appreciate your support, and I appreciate your conversation.
Thank you so much. Right. Bye.
So if other people wanted to step up and chat up, I would be happy. There was a guy... Well, I say was. He's dead now. He died, it wasn't even too long ago. He died kind of old. He died in, he died in 1998, gave his final lecture a few weeks before he died. He was 82. Now, he spent his career studying other scientists at Bell Labs. Bell Labs was like this. Did they come up with the mouse and GUI interfaces and so on? All the stuff that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, kind of half ripped off from everyone. And he gave a lecture in 1986. I know this sounds obscure and ancient and so on, but this guy, Richard Hamming, he won the Turing Award. He invented these error-correcting codes that made modern computing possible. The stuff where you say in most computer languages, you have an error handler. Oh, try to get too nerdy, but so an error handler is, let's say that you ask someone for their date of birth, and this is sort of back in the day. Now you spin all of these wheels and you can't enter anything wrong, right? Because they say, month, day, year, and you've got to pick these pinwheels, and boy, you're getting older when you got to scroll for 20 minutes to get to your birth year. But he came up with these error correcting codes, and I think what they are is that not an expert on his sort of history of programming, but if you had a text input and you couldn't control what people would type in, and you'd say, enter date of birth, and they would say, February 31st, 1975. And you'd say, well, even on a leap year, there's no February 31st, there's only February 29th. So February 31st is not a valid date. And so in computer parlance, there are a number of different data types, right? There's bytes, which are true, false, integers, minus 32767 to plus 32767, no decimals. And then there are longs, and then there are doubles, which is a whole bunch of decimals. And there are blobs, which are just a bunch of different varchars, just any data you want, you can stuff in it. And generally with coding, you want to say, the variable, like the user input, is going to go into a particular particular kind of data. So if you say to someone, enter your age, and they type in AB, and you take that back and you try and put AB into a variable. A variable is a little pocket of memory where you store some data. And if you say, well, obviously, the age has to be a number. And I don't care about decimals. I'm 46.7 is not an age that would make much sense. So I've got an age, and it has to be a number, because I'm going to put it in a variable, a little pocket of memory, and I've defined that pocket of memory as a number. Now, if somebody, you say to somebody, what's your age? And they type in 47, like F-O-R-T-Y-S-E-V-E-N, and you haven't expected that. And then you say, okay, put this bunch of letters into this little memory pocket that can only take numbers. The computer's going to say, no can do, senor. Depends if you bought it in Tijuana or something like that. But the computer's going to say that's an error because obviously you can't take the text code 47 and put it into a little memory pocket that is only designed for numbers. And certainly back in the day, when memory was at a premium, I mean, the first computer I took home from the computer lab at my junior high school had 2K of memory, which means it could store 2,048 characters. That was it. 2K, right? There's K, then there's megs, then there's gigs, and now terabytes and so on. It's a ridiculously tiny slice of data. And then the first computer that I bought had 8K of memory, which I later expanded to 48K of memory. And then, gosh, I had a computer with 640K of memory, which Bill Gates famously said ought to be enough for everyone. And then we don't have to list through it all. Then we don't have to list through. I think I then had a meg of memory on my Atari ST? Anyway, so a computer, if you try and put text into a number memory pocket, the computer will say, I don't know what to do with that. This is only supposed to take numbers, and it will throw up an error. And what this guy did was he designed, I think, and I could be wrong about this, but this is my understanding, he designed computer programming that would let the computer say, oh, there's an error, and it would return to the programmer the type of error it was. So this would be a type conversion. The type is text, and you have tried to put text into a number memory pocket that can only take numbers, and you had to really define all your variables because it's a way of catching errors as well. And so in BASIC, you would say, on error, go to, and then you would have a named part of the program, err, underbar, handler, colon, or something like that. And then you'd say, okay, well, if this type of error, right, so a type conversion error where you try and put text into a number would give you a particular error code. And a lot of times you would define particular numbers and give them actual variable names. So instead of maybe the error code for stuffing text into a number pocket is error 47 or 46 or something like that, but you'd make it more user-friendly for the programmer who might have to debug your code, and you'd say err underbar type underbar conversion equals 46. And so if the error equals err type conversion, then send a message to the user that says, sorry, you need to enter two-digit numbers, right? So if you're doing it for work, nobody's 9 who's there, and nobody's 100 who's there. And so you'd say, you got to enter a two-digit number. And so those would be hard errors. And so this guy created this whole system where the programming language would throw an error. You'd have to catch the error, and you'd have to tell the user to change it, right? And those are hard errors. Soft errors would be somebody enters 99. So you've got two numbers that you accept, and they enter 99. And I mean, if you're doing a payroll program, the odds of there being somebody on the payroll who's 99 years old are very low. So you might not reject it, but you might say, are you sure that you're 99 years old? And either you would or wouldn't let it continue, or whether you might log the error for to be checked later or something like that. So this sort of error stuff came about in this kind of way. Now, this guy was really interesting because he studied really, really powerful thinkers, people who had achieved an enormous amount in the realm of mathematics or physics or science. He just went through and just observed. You know, one of these people who just observes, just observe and absorb, right? So he spent 30 years sitting in a cafeteria, just observing people, chatting, and he tried to figure out which scientists become memorable, world-changing, legendary scientists, and the other ones who, you know, they show up, they do okay work, you know, it's fine. And then, you know, 8 minutes after they retire, people can't even remember what they look like. So he had a theory. It's a tripartite theory about success. And again, I'm happy to take your comments or questions, if you like, about this. The tripartite theory of success. I want you guys to be as successful as you can be. So he said that it was not just luck. It wasn't just IQ. We assume that everyone at the top tier of Bell Labs is super smart. And of course, as you know, Einstein's IQ was only in the 120s. There are people who've got far higher IQs who've achieved far less than someone like Einstein. So raw IQ is not it. Luck is not it. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting about this, the first habit he said, and this is the one that's toughest to hear for a lot of people. So in any field, there are the big, giant, monolithic, intractable problems, right? The unified field theory. Can we tie all the strong and weak atomic forces together with gravity and electromagnetism and all the other things, fission, fusion, all the other things that go on? Is there a single theory for everything? That's the biggest holy grail in physics by far. So that's the big, big, meaty, challenging problem in physics. In philosophy, it's a rational proof of secular ethics. Or, as it will be known in the future, my big charge and achievement. I'm working on a short movie about all of this at the moment. freedomain.com/donate if you would like to help out. Thank you, thank you, thank you. But the big one in philosophy is a rational proof of secular ethics, which you can get in the last third of my book, Essential Philosophy. You can also get the book, Universally Preferable Behavior, A Rational Proof of Secular Ethics, at freedomain.com/books. I hope you will check it out. That's the big one. In other fields, I don't know, I'm not that much of an expert in other fields. The big one in biology, of course, was evolution. That was the sometimes called the single greatest idea any individual human being has ever had, other than my mother and father conceiving me, of course. But that is, my daughter's just giving me a yapping gesture. Is that right?
I just walked down and I hear it's the second greatest idea other than, I can't even talk, conceiving me. I'm just laughing. What's going on?
Laughing with joy and pride?
What a career.
What a career. That's right. Talking at home. All right. So he said, with regards to the scientists, he said, look, you are afraid to take on and tackle the very biggest problems in your field because you're too afraid of failure. You're too afraid of failure. Because if you say, as I have said, if you say, I have solved the biggest problem in the history of philosophy, which I never imagined I was going to do, by the way. I've been very tentative in approaching any value I have to add in the world. I assume at the basis, at the very bottom of things, I assume I have no value to add at all. And every shred of value I have to really earn and work my hardest to achieve. So when you hear me say, I have solved the biggest problem in the history of philosophy and the most important intellectual problem to solve in the history of humanity, I have solved it. Of course, your first instinct, and I don't fault anyone for this at all. This is not a complaint, because I would be the same way. And if I would be the same way, and I am the standard of value, blah, blah, blah. But no, that your first, if I make this claim, I have solved the biggest problem in the history of philosophy, the most essential problem in humanity as a whole. I mean, you may cough it, but you're thinking, bullshit, right? You're thinking, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous. Some guy on the internet, I mean, you don't even have a PhD in philosophy. You're not teaching at Harvard or Stanford or anything like that, man. Who on earth are you to make this completely ridiculous claim It's not true. It cannot be true. And of course, if you know about the history of philosophy, you know that a lot of significant contributions to philosophy come from outside the academic world, right? In the same way that Einstein was a patent clerk, right? And then, of course, well, of course, Einstein was, the government liked him because he gave them nuclear weapons, right? So that's a big plus. So one of the reasons why people fail is they don't aim themselves in their minds at the very biggest problems for two reasons. One, they're afraid they're going to fail. And two, they're afraid they're going to be mocked, attacked. Even if they say, I'm working on the very biggest problem in physics. I'm working on it. I'm going to solve it. Because, you know, you're not going to work on something unless you really feel you can solve it. And I remember when I was so frustrated and angered at not having a rational proof of secular ethics that I remember sitting down like 20 years ago and saying, I remember sitting down at a big cup of coffee and I'm like, I don't care how much I have to pee. I am not getting up from this table until I've solved this problem. And oh my God, it was horrendous. It was a horrendous process to work on solving that problem. I felt like my brain was melting and dripping down my spinal cord. It was horrendous. I wouldn't say it's the most intellectual labor or effort that I've ever put into anything, but it was certainly up there. So people are afraid if you say, if you were on the faculty, like at Harvard or something like that, you're on the faculty and people say, oh, you've got a sabbatical coming up or we want to hire you or something like that. And then you say, I want to solve the entire problem of secular ethics. I want a final rational proof for the problem of secular ethics. People would just be like, oh, come on. Man, the greatest minds in human history have been working on that one for 3,000 years, and nobody's ever achieved it. Who are you to think what? Oh, you're just so smart that you just get what everyone else doesn't get, and so on. And I think I'm smart, but my big thing is that I have the intelligence honed by brutal child abuse, but also I've dealt with the brutal child abuse with years of therapy. And so I have all of those skills and the focus, consistency, commitment, and virtue to be able to work on ethics without them condemning me, right? Very few people have been able to work on ethics without feeling condemned by ethics. So anyway, that's sort of a bit of a sidebar, but can you imagine just going to the faculty and saying, I'm going to solve the problem that no philosopher in the history of the world has ever solved. They would think you were mental. They would think you were deranged, that you had a serious mental health issue, that you had, oh, you're a megalomaniac, you're mad, you're grandiose, you're whatever, like you've got some sort of narcissistic insanity personality disorder where you just think that you can do everything. And people would get really upset and roll their eyes and think you were crazy. And people don't want to do that. They don't want to go through that process of having ridiculously high ambitions because you're afraid of failure. You're afraid of wasting your time. It takes a ridiculous, I wouldn't say, it takes a ridiculous amount of self-confidence, or rather confidence in your ability to consistently apply reason. It takes a ridiculous amount of confidence to even think you could. I wasn't even that confident. I was just really pissed off. And, you know, being pissed off is a pretty good, necessity is the mother of invention. I really wanted to be a public philosopher, but I also didn't really want to just repeat what other people had said. I mean, I am not a cover band. I want to do my own material, right? So it is very tough for people to aim at the very biggest problem. And what they do, of course, is they say, you know, I'm going to tackle something else. I'm going to tackle, you know, maybe I'll compare the metaphysics of Nietzsche to the epistemology of Hume or something like that, you know, and something that's, it's okay. It's not terrible. It's not that interesting. And it's certainly not going to change the world. So a lot of thinkers, they avoid the big, big, big problem in the field. And they picked something not too complicated, not too challenging. I mean, I remember when I was doing my graduate degree in the history of philosophy. And I mean, it was a history degree, but I really focused on the philosophy aspect. And I said, I have a thesis that I want to prove with reference to four major thinkers, Plato, Kant, Locke, and Hegel, that those who believe in a higher reality must always end up proposing dictatorship as their ideal political model, right? That was sort of, and I could not find anybody who was willing to let me do that. They said it was way too ambitious, it was way too big, I didn't speak enough German to be able to do it, and, you know, it probably would be good to know ancient Greek so I could read Plato in the original and so on. And there were just all these barriers. And I spent months combing all over the faculty, just trying to find someone who would let me do this. And I won't say I bullied, because what could I do? I was just a grad student. But I ended up getting a professor to let me give it a shot. And I handed in a first draft, and he said, I don't know if you've done it. I don't know. And so I worked on a bunch of different drafts, and I ended up graduating because it took them forever. The committee that gives you the graduate degree or not, it took them forever. And I ended up getting an A, but it was a brutal process to get my thesis approved, to get it supervised. I just went to so many people who were, I mean, they just rolled their eyes and said, come on, it's not even a PhD. This would be insane for a PhD thesis. This is just a master's degree. What are you doing? And this is like, but the question isn't, why am I doing it? The question is, why aren't you doing it? Why would you want to live in some corner office mouthing the same platitudes you have for decades and decades and boring the pants off everyone? Why wouldn't you want to go for broke? Go big or go home. So that's the number one reason why people fail, is they simply refuse to take on the biggest issues out of a fear of failure, a fear of mockery, a fear of being ridiculed. Now, the other thing that he noticed was doors, believe it or not, doors. Now, he noticed that the scientists in this at Bell Labs, I mean, there were two kinds of scientists. One kept the doors closed all the time, and the others kept their doors open. Now, if you keep your door closed, of course, you get a lot more work done in the short run. You're not getting interrupted and so on. If you keep your door open, people knock, hey, Bob, have you heard the latest? Or can you believe this? Or I thought you might be interested. And they come in, they sit down, and they're constantly interrupting you, persons from Porlock style, right? And so you don't get as much work done in the short run, but you're getting much more exposure to the general tenor, ebb, and flow of thought in your field this way. And so one of the reasons why I don't work in isolation is because that's why I'm constantly asking for questions. I'm constantly doing call-ins and so on. I'll do solo shows, sure. But I want to stay in conversation because I want the thoughts of the world to pass through my mind. It opens up great topics, great perspectives. I thought we had a great chat with Richard this evening about security and safety, that temporary safety is in fact suicidal risk in the long run. Overprotecting your children will cause your civilization to fall because you don't end up with a generation of men who have the courage that can only come from working with real risk as children. And so I thought that was, I wouldn't have had that conversation if, in a sense, my door hadn't been open, if that makes sense. Now, the third habit is inversion. So Hamming wanted to do something in computer science, the scientist, mathematician, he wanted to do something in computer science. And he went to his superiors, his supervisors, his bosses, and he said, I'm going to need a team of programmers. And they went back and forth, but eventually they said, no, we don't have the money. We don't think it's a good enough project. And so he didn't get what he wanted. Now, he like most people, you ask and you're really passionate about your project. And if other people aren't passionate about your project, you get kind of mad at them, right? Obviously. And he stewed on this for weeks and weeks. Until, and I don't know if he's ever explained this process, he flipped the script. Flipping the script is one of the most important things you can do in life. I have been joyfully married for like 24 years. Every day is a blast. We laugh half the day. It's so much fun. And an absolute furnace of my heart and the gravity of my soul is embodied in the lovely form of my wife. Now, of course, I dated before I met her. And of course, every breakup was like, oh man, you know, either oh man, I'm going, or oh man, she's going, or whatever, right? And it would be a negative. And of course, now looking back upon it, I'm like, I would like to publicly thank every single woman who ditched me, because that left me free to meet and marry the woman who became my wife. It's flipping the script. Deplatforming. I've talked about this before. I'll keep it really brief. Deplatforming freed me to work on projects that were the most important to me. I've written 3 books since deplatforming, and I had the great opportunity to engage in more jazz club discussions with people, and I ended up producing work that has far more relevance in the long run. I mean, when I was on the politics treadmill, the current events treadmill, which I didn't mind, I thought it was interesting and fun and fine, there's nothing wrong with it, but it fades. I mean, nobody cares what I had to say about some political event 10 years ago. But some of the work that I've been doing since then is longer lasting, is more foundational. And so I got freed from audience capture, because my audience grew when I did politics. I got freed from audience capture. I got to have much more intimate conversations, and I got to do work that will last the test of time. And what I sort of said to myself was, when I was sort of wrestling with this, because sometimes it can be, it can be a little tough to see the good in the bad. And what I said to myself was, will people 100 years from now, 500 years from now, will they be happy if I was deplatformed or not? And given that what I talk about now will be more relevant to people in 100 years than anything I ever did in politics, or all the things I did in politics put together, which were helpful in the now, but not so much helpful in the future, it goes back to this question of Mark Twain. How many people read Mark Twain's newspaper columns versus the novels that he wrote? Well, nobody reads his newspaper columns, and everyone reads his novels, or at least knows those stories. And so I don't know why Mark Twain wrote these novels, but let's say that Mark Twain wrote these novels because he got fired from his newspaper job. Well, he'd say, man, this is a real drag. I got fired from my newspaper job. That was a steady source of income. And I had, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers and was moving the needle on current events and so on. And that's very tempting in the here and now. But in the future, they will be very happy that I was deplatformed. In other words, deplatforming me gave me no choice but to abandon. Well, it did give me a choice, but the incentives pointed towards abandoning the treadmill and the audience capture of politics and working on things that were more foundational, long-lasting, and will produce more effects in the future that are positive than effects in the present that are transitive. So it was a plus. So when Hamming, the guy I'm talking about, when he couldn't get his programmers, he said, okay, well, I'm going to make this good. So I can't get the programmers. What if I get the computer to write the program itself? And that pushed him right to the frontier of computer science. If you can flip the script, you haven't been dumped. Your heart has been opened for a better person. You haven't been fired. You have been released to find something that fits your skills better. I mean, I've been fired a couple of times over the course of my life. Yeah, it kind of sucks, but I ended up exactly where it is best for me and best for the world. And that was the third thing, flipping the script. The fourth thing is something that makes sense in hindsight, but it's a little tough to see up front. And what makes sense in hindsight is, if you just think about it at the surface level, you say, you know what, I'm just going to work 10% harder than the guy next to me. and you say, okay, so I'm going to end up with a career that's 10% better. No, that's not how it works. You know, compound interest is the only math that is really magical in terms of most people's everyday understanding of how their lives can be improved mathematically. You know, that old thing, like the guy says to the king, I want you to give me, I put out a chessboard, one grain on the first piece, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 1024, 2048, 4096, and so on. And of course, by the end of the chessboard, he owns more grain than the king can ever produce. So if you work 10% harder, you don't end up with a career that's 10% better. You end up with a career that's 100 times better. Because the 10% compounds every year. If you go the little bit of an extra mile, all you feel that day is the little bit of extra mile that you put out. It's all you feel. Some guy stays 8 hours, right? And you stay an extra, what, 45 minutes, 50 minutes. Oh, man, I'm out 50 minutes. I mean, I'm not talking about necessarily hours. It could be concentration, right? So some guy works at 75% and you work at 85%. Yeah. I mean, you're 10 points up. It's a little bit more than 10% because 10% of 75 would be 7.5, right? 82.5. So it's a little bit more, 11, 12%. Now, but that compounds every day, every month, every year. It compounds. And I, over the course of my life, have worked just a little bit harder than other people and taken a little bit more risk than other people. And when I was in university, I wrote extra papers. I read extra books. I worked extra hard. I wrote my papers ahead of time. And sometimes I worked too hard in an area that I thought had a future that didn't, right? So when I was in my undergraduate, I spent way too much time acting and acting in plays and writing plays and both acting and writing and producing and directing plays. I thought that there was something in that for me going forward. And I mean, the skills weren't terrible going forward. I mean, I think that acting training and voice training and so on has helped me quite a bit in what I do here. But I've always worked a little harder. And I'm not crazy work that way. I mean, was it Tim Pool was saying like 16 hours a day, 14? He's like, bro, you have a kid. For heaven's sakes, go home. You know, go home, Mr. Beanie. It's literally not that serious. You're not changing the world with every show. But I think he has, is it he or Crowder have got like 17 employees and so on? So there's other people who work harder, for sure. There's no question, right? I mean, I've put in my hours, my Lord. I mean, I remember there were a couple of years before, 2019. Like, I was traveling, I was doing documentaries, I was giving speeches, like, I was all over the map and a half. I spent like a third of my year traveling with my family, which was, you know, interesting and fun, but, you know, my daughter obviously wanted more stable relationships, and that all made good sense. So certainly there were times when I was putting in a lot of hours. And, you know, even over the last couple of years, I've written Peaceful Parenting. I wrote my novel, The Future. I wrote my novel, The Present. I wrote my novel, four books. And I wrote my novel called Dissolution. It's all great books. And I also recorded the audiobook of Almost, which is 24 hours or 26 hours, 28 hours, 30 hours. It's a huge book, 320,000 words. And I, of course, I've done all these shows and I've done a lot of work. And I'm happy with it. I'm pleased with it. And it really compounds. It really compounds. I've done some debates as well. Some good and useful stuff. And I went down and did Sam Hyde's show. I went down and did that live. It's taking a while to come out. And yeah, Sam contacted me because I said, hey, what's happening with my show? And he says, oh, we had to put on a guy who's looks maxing. And I said, hey, man, that implies that I am not Lux Baxing. How is this conceivable? Apparently, it's conceivable. I don't know how, but it is. That's fine. Come on, he's a comedian. He should put me on as a Lux Maxer. That would be hilarious. So, I've done some work. I'm pleased with the work. You can always do more. I get that, but not always. Actually, I shouldn't say there is a work is an Aristotelian mean as well. There is a level at which work diminishes. There's diminishing returns, right? I think we've all been there. I'll study more. It's like, I'll never sleep. Right? I've certainly been there. So that is the fourth habit, right? Which is just put in that little bit of extra effort. And I know it's a drag at the time. I know it is. I know it's a drag at the time. But it absolutely compounds. I mean, just spend an extra 10% of time at the gym working hard. And it changes your entire physique. Just put in the extra effort. Any competent boss will notice it. You know, if you've never been a boss, I'll give you a big secret. Big secret here. Bosses know everything. Just so you know. Just so there's no shock in this. Bosses know everything. Bosses know exactly how hard you are or are not working. I mean, we have an instinct for these kinds of things. Oh, I've had to have some conversations over the years. Competent bosses, good bosses, know exactly how hard you're working, and they know exactly whether you're putting in any extra effort, energy. And it's not to do with hours necessarily, but bosses know if you're putting in that extra effort or energy or not. They know. They have a massive, massive instinct for these kinds of things. It's kind of why they're the boss, because they know how productive people are or are not. So just be aware of that. All right, so sum it up, shall we? So don't avoid the big issues. Don't avoid the big problems. You know, if you're a salesman, don't go for the easy sale that doesn't make that much. Go for the big sale. If you've got any problem anywhere, try and figure out what that problem is and just absorb it. Like, be like a big gelatinous cube. Just flow around it and absorb it. And don't worry about being considered overambitious. Being considered overambitious is just a cope from people who haven't achieved their own potential. And stay away from people like that. Talk to people. Don't be isolated with your problems. Don't just sit there and work on them on your own. Talk with people. Communicate with people. Go back and forth with people. This is the open doors versus the closed doors of the mathematicians at Bell Labs. Very, very important. Flip the script, man. It's a cheesy but very real statement. Every setback is an opportunity. Every disaster can be judo-style turned into an advantage. Do not let circumstances dictate how you think and respond to things in the world. What matters is not what happens to you. What matters is what you think about it. And you and I and no one are ever smart enough to know whether it's going to be good or bad down the road. I mean, deplatforming cost me money, cost me audience, but it's been entirely worth it to have moved the Overton window, to have written the books that I have written since. Is well worth it to have had the great close conversations and in particular peaceful parenting. A peaceful parenting I don't think would have happened without deplatforming. I needed the time. So take on the big issues, stay in conversation with people, flip the script, put in the extra effort consistently, and your life ends up in a completely different place. All right. Richard, did you want to come back?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I have a bit of a truth bomb to let go. And this is tied into exactly what you were just talking about.
Oh, good. I like synchronicity.
Right. Anyway, this is all for the for the Christians out there, and this is going to be harsh, and I'm not saying it in a cruel way, Jesus was not a Christian. And in one of his, I think it was the book of John 14:12, Jesus tells his followers that the work he does, that they will do greater works. And I feel like if that was actually taken seriously, then people would appreciate that you are doing the greater work. And I feel like people need to take this seriously.
This meaning what?
That you are doing the greater work. That he, when he came, the time and place that he was born in wasn't really ready. He shook things up, okay? There's no doubt about that. But the problem being is that, you know, it's ironic, it's kind of, I find it ironic that all the kind of, all the bullshit starts up as soon as someone dies. And, you know, it's easy to construct some, you know, ideology around anybody once they're dead. Because they, you know, they're no longer around to speak for themselves. But if we take what he said seriously, then I feel like he was saying, no, listen up. You will do greater works than he has done. And I feel like he was speaking to the future in that sense. And people didn't get it at the time. And I feel like, yeah, we are in that place now where you have taken up that mantle and you are carrying that torch, if you like. And not from a supernaturalist standpoint.
No, I get that. I'm not walking on water.
I'm not talking about any of that. Yeah.
No, that's very kind. I appreciate that's high praise, and I very much appreciate it. And I will say that, I mean, the question of whether Jesus was a Christian to me is interesting, and the parallels would be something like, was Aristotle a logician? Because Aristotle largely invented the modern discipline of logic. Was Socrates Socratic? Did he employ Socratic reasoning? I would say yes.
Yeah.
I would say yes. That Aristotle was a logician, though he invented logic or discovered logic or synthesized logic from reality. I would also say that Socrates employed Socratic reasoning, though it wasn't called that. And in the same way that Einstein came up with the general and special theories of relativity, and therefore he was an Einsteinian, although he was in fact Einstein. So in the same vein, I would say that Jesus was a Christian in that he derived Christianity by taking traditional Judaic principles and universalizing them as a whole and injecting far more empathy for the other than had hitherto existed. So I appreciate that. But what I would also say is that one thing I've really disliked about, or one thing I don't like about religion, is that you have a perfect creature at the center of the religion, a perfect God, or in this case, an amalgam between the human and the divine.
Yeah.
So in Christianity in particular, you have a perfect human being, half human, half God, and so on, whose virtue we can never, ever hope to even get close to, because he was infinitely good, infinitely perfect, and so on. And there, of course, we could think of other religious figures who have the same absolute perfection. And to me, that is such an unrealistic standard for human beings that, in general, it gives people more of an excuse for their own bad behavior.
Yeah.
I remember there was some snippet from a cop show I was flipping through many years ago where some cop was going to do something ugly or vicious or nasty or something like that, and he was a Christian. And somebody said, it's like, hey, but you're a Christian. What would Jesus do? And he said, Jesus is perfect. I'm not. And that really struck me as quite a powerful statement that because you have a standard of behavior that it's absolutely impossible for human beings to even approach. Human beings can approach the perfection of Jesus in the way that a human lifespan can approach immortality.
Yeah, yeah.
And a human lifespan in the face of immortality ceases to exist in all but the most minuscule dimensions. It is a division by zero error.
Yep.
And so if you have an infinitely perfect human being that you are supposed to emulate, because it is a standard you will never, ever be able to achieve, it is almost like an excuse for bad behavior. Well, Jesus is perfect. I'm not. I can't ever hope to approach the perfection of Jesus. I will never. The virtues that I'm capable of consistently maintaining fade to atomic nothingness in the face of Jesus's infinite perfection. And I just don't like it. I mean, yeah. I've always said, and you've heard it a million times in the show, like, I struggle with these things too. I'm far from perfect. I'm still, you know, I've said this even in the show last night, you know, that I still have to remind myself to be as honest and direct as possible. It's not a habit that I was raised with, but it's something that I really need to continue to remind myself to work to do and to achieve.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, I mean, I originated a lot of these ideas, although a lot of them, of course, predate me. I just synthesize them and communicate them, hopefully effectively. But I struggle with these things. I have challenges with maintaining these virtues. There are times when I fail my own courage. There are times when I fail my own integrity. There are times when I fail my own honesty. And these are not divine standards. These are not at all impossible to achieve or to maintain. Yeah. I think I do a pretty good job. You know, it's kind of like diet and exercise. I'm not going to win any competition anytime soon, but I think I do a pretty good job. And the fact that we have these ideal standards is fine, a standard called honesty, but the standard is not actionable. The standard does not act any more than you can drive over the blueprint of a bridge.
Right.
So the standard does not act. The standard is a useful guide, but it is only human beings that act. And the maximum human virtue should be what we aspire to that can be achieved.
Yep.
You know, we think if somebody lives to, what is it, serve as a meme today, Dick Van Dyke has lived to be 100, which means he can now not officially play with Lego because it's 3 to 99. And so, you know, we think Dick Van Dyke's lived to be 100. Man, that's pretty good. I think Clint Eastwood just passed 100. Skinny guys who exercised a lot. Good for them, right? Good for them. You don't see a lot of old, fat people. Yeah. But so we live to 100. We say that's a good life. We don't say that sucks in the face of eternity. We say that's a good life. We have to have a human achievable standard of virtue. Otherwise, the lack of infinity and the lack of perfection becomes an excuse.
Yep.
It would be like somebody who's 80 looking at Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime and saying, I'm never going to look like that. What's the point of exercising at all? Because it's impossible for him to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's impossible for Arnold Schwarzenegger to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime, and he still works out. So I think that the standard of perfection provides way too many excuses for people to say, well, Jesus is perfect. I'm not. And it's kind of an excuse. And so I appreciate your kind words. I do think that we have a long way to go as far as virtue and integrity as a species, or even just basic honesty sometimes. Hopefully I can model that and other people can model it to me and so on. My wife is very honest and direct, and I've learned an enormous amount from her about these things, and it's beautiful. And so I hope that we can all keep going, because that's the beauty. Somebody was posting today, like, what is the real actual purpose of life? It's like, tell the truth, do good, fight evil. I mean, that's the most human thing we can do. Yeah. Animals can't tell the truth or lie.
Yep.
Animals can't fight evil. Animals can't promote the good. It is the most specifically human things that we can do. That which is appropriate to human beings must be that which only human beings can do.
Yeah, 100%.
Tell the truth, fight evil, do good. These are the most specific and powerful and positive human actions that we can take. All right. Thank you for that speech. If there's anything else you wanted to mention.
No, that's great. And thank you so much, Stefan. Like, I was just trying to say, it's the edifice that is built up around people when they're dead is, it's too bad, I think, right? I was trying to bring the story back to him as a human being and not as something else that was built up after the fact that he was dead. That's all I was trying to make.
Yeah, and of course, if he is divine and perfect, then everything he says must be divine and perfect.
Yep.
I, myself, think that when he said on the crucifixion, on the cross, when he said, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
Yeah.
I think that was a cry of shock and horror. I think that we look at Jesus as a man who tried to take tribalism and merge it with universalism. He tried to take tribalism of his environment and merge it with the Greco-Roman focus on philosophy, reason, and universals.
Yeah.
And I think that he was expecting to be saved. I think he was honest when he said, "Why have you forsaken me?"
Yeah, me too.
And that, to me, humanizes Jesus and makes what he did attainable in a human dimension, rather than everything he said and did had to be perfect. You know, like he took the demons from people and put them into pigs, and the pigs ran off a cliff. Yeah. Well, if he can do anything, why doesn't he just put them into a stone or a tree? Yeah. Like, why does he have to put them into pigs that have to run off a cliff? But because he's perfect, you have to then explain that as the most moral thing, no matter, other than, you know, maybe he just made a mistake.
Yep.
And maybe he didn't know he could put them into trees, didn't he? Maybe he was still toying with his omnipotence and so on, right? I mean, if I woke up tomorrow being able to do miracles, I don't think I'd do them very well at all to begin with. So maybe he was just learning. So I think that keeping morals in the human dimension is really essential.
Yeah,
because otherwise it's way too easy to excuse what we do.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for a wonderful evening of conversation, and thanks in particular to Richard for summoning great thoughts from the conversation, and I really do appreciate that. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Please don't forget some great books, freedomain.com/books, peacefulparenting.com, shop.freedomain.com, and freedomain.com/documentaries. You should check them out. And also, call-in shows, man. You know, if I think for the first time in 21 years, I'm not booked up solid. So please come and get a call-in show. They're free, or you can pay for private ones if you want to keep it off the internet. freedomain.com/call. Love you guys. We'll talk Tuesday at 10 a.m. Bye.